Chatter on Books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back, everybody, to Chatter on Books. Hope you're doing well and staying healthy. I can't believe that I'm now starting year three of sincerely asking people how they're doing and hoping that they're staying healthy, but that's where we are. In just a little bit, we are going to be talking to an author named James Kestrel, who also has another name, and we'll be talking about that. And he is the author of a book called Five Decembers. I'm just going to read you what the New York Times said about it. War, imprisonment, torture, romance. The novel has an almost operatic symmetry in Kestrel turns a beautiful phrase, which is pretty good from the New York Times. Right now, we have Lauren Larson filling in graciously for Claude Jennings, doing all the important work. David Aldrin zooming in with an awesome sweatshirt. And one of our favorite Chatter on Books alums, Ed Eimer. Ed, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And I loved James's book, so I'm really excited to be here.
We're going to kind of kick it off. I'm going to kick it off and then just turn it over to you two guys, because I think you are, you know, brothers from another mother. Seriously, and how you write. And then it made me have all these questions about noir, N-O-I-R, which I'm sure I'm mispronouncing. That's it.
I think that's okay. Right.
That's going to be your segment. Okay, first and foremost, David, relatively healthy. As far as we know, COVID-free.
Relatively, yeah. But, you know, just, oh, God, just ate like a drunken sailor.
What was your...
My metaphor is there.
What was your favorite thing you ate over the holidays?
I don't remember. There was so much of it. You know, it's like, it felt like I had ham every day for a week. I don't even know if that's even
nice
legal.
Spiral ham.
It just stuffing bone into every cranium, every crevice of my being. It's just disgusting. Oh my God. I think this is what happens to human beings in the wintertime because it's cold.
Sure.
And this is a natural millions sure. of years of evolution. Response to cold is that I have to fatten up for the winter to stay warm.
So. I think that is completely legitimate. Completely. Ed?
Or I could just have no willpower whatsoever. It could be that too.
Ed, healthy as far as we know?
Yeah, as far as I know, COVID-free. I did have a similar experience to David. You know that, I don't know if you've had that moment where you're eating and you look up at like a Christmas dinner or New Year's or whatever, and everyone at the table is just gazing, is just staring at you in horror. And you just kind of want to be like, what did you see? What was I doing? You know, it was that sort of like your Zoom camera was on just now. I had no idea, you know, that kind of moment. But other than that, my goal was to gain enough weight that I could last year that I could have a good resolution this year to lose it. So I'm really excited. Two goals, one goal.
Planning.
That's good. Do you do New Year's resolutions?
Good Lord, no.
Yeah, I gave up long ago. Ed, New Year's resolutions?
No, I mean, it's I don't want another mark of failure.
Just setting ourselves up for it. Exactly. Exactly. Okay, so Claude is hopefully still in Millbrook, Virginia, celebrating Sierra's birthday, which I think they do every year. And hopefully he snowed it in a beautiful place at the Salamander or something like that.
Yeah.
And we will talk about this when he comes back. But David or Ed, are you guys familiar with the Marconi Awards from the National Association of Broadcasters?
I suspect it has something to do with radio.
Well, it's out of the National Association of Broadcasters. It is. And I used to do work in this town. I've done work for everybody, but used to do work for NAB. And the Marconi Awards are a big daggone deal. It's a nationwide thing, and it's just like the Academy Awards of radio, if you will. Among the many things Claude does is work at WGTS, which is a Christian music radio station. I think they tape out of Rockville, but it's a DMV show. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure I get his buddy's name right. Claude and Jerry Woods won the Radio Podcast of the Year.
Woo!
Yeah, for a podcast called We Need to Talk. Addresses issues of race in America and emphasize bringing people from different backgrounds together. So there we go.
That's great.
Congratulations to Claude.
Congratulations.
We'll rave about him some more next week, but only Claude. I mean, if David or I won something like that, we'd be calling each other. We'd be having a drink. And I just want to point out that Claude's podcast won Podcast of the Year, not this one.
Exactly.
You're working on
Don't
that.
You think that's as it should be?
Yeah, it is. Okay. Okay, so Ed, when we have James Kestrel on, one of the things I want to ask him about is the fact that he writes now under a pseudonym. It seems to be doing very well for him. You do too. EA Bars, right?
I did. Yeah.
Did? Is it past tense? Are we over EA Bars?
I'm
over like it. Sybil? Is this like Sybil? Are you going to have several different names and personalities?
I'm not. I'm going to, I wrote my last book under that name, but I have a new 2-book deal with Thomas and Mercer. The next book's coming out in February of 2023, and I'll be back to EA Amar.
Okay, so the real name. Why did you pick a pseudonym in the first place, and how did you pick the one you picked?
I thought it would be fun. You know, I had no real idea for it. The publisher thought it might be a good thing as well. This book was a bit of a departure from my first book. So there's a separation there and a distance. Uh-huh. And it's, pseudonyms are great. I think they can serve a number of purposes, but you have to have the right attitude and the right approach to them. And I really didn't have either. And I didn't end up enjoying it, you know, and it didn't make sense for me. It didn't make sense for the way that I've sort of positioned myself.
Uh-huh. So the last name was Barres, correct?
Right, right.
How did you pick that name?
I wanted something that was sort of ethnically ambiguous, like me, where people are like, I'm not sure what, but something.
Right, right.
That's really what I was going for.
Yeah.
So, and I liked the name Barres. I thought it had a sort of a musical, or I think it has sort of a musical quality to it that I enjoyed.
Very nice. David, if you had a pseudonym, what would it be?
You know, I've been thinking about this, and I was thinking something like J.K. Rowling, something like that. I know. It just kind of came to me. I didn't really, not based on any particular thing. Maybe that would help.
It might help. It might help. I wonder what would happen if you did something like that. I can never think of a good name, but now since I've discovered from 23andMe that I'm like 10-15% Scandinavian, which, by the way, none of my sisters have any Scandinavian in them. Just saying.
You don't know that.
No, we do know that.
Did they get tested?
Yeah. Oh, 23andMe and a little more additional testing from an even higher source. So, yeah. So, just saying. Topic for another show.
The Maury show.
So, yeah. So, I'm thinking, I'm getting tired of Tori. I've had that for so long. I'm like Heidi. You know, maybe Gretel, something like that, just going forward. Great. Or just one name. The pseudonym could just be one name.
There we go.
Okay, I didn't tell you guys this, but I have a pop quiz on pseudonyms.
Oh, God.
Yes,
this
makes me so happy. There'll be a winner. Somebody will win this. I'm going to give you the pseudonym and a little bit of information. Then you have to guess the real person. And this might, David, this might be skewed a little bit toward Ed. I just want to say, based on the...
I'm going to get trounced here, but that's all right.
You lost the last contest to Nevin, didn't you?
Well, of course, because Nevin's like way smarter and more talented than I.
Than all of us. Okay, so this person, English, wrote 66 novels and a bunch of short story collections under their own name. I'm saying there, so we don't know what gender it is.
Okay.
But also wrote 6 romance novels. Well, now I'm going to give it away. Under the name... Mary Westmacott, Westmacott.
Agatha Christie.
Wow, David! Yay! How did you know that?
Because I always sell short and name high.
Wow!
I thought Rubens wrote a lot of books. Come on.
Excellent. Okay, 1-0, David, up. Okay, the pseudonym is Paul French. This author and professor, known for works of science fiction, was also asked and hired to write a juvenile science fiction novel that would serve as the basis for a television series. And he was horrified and thought it would just turn into the drivel that was on television at the time. So he came up with the name Paul French, but pretty famous.
I mean, I'm just going to say Bradbury.
No, but close. Isaac Asimov.
Ah.
Right. Yeah,
David, I knew you didn't know that one. So, okay, it's still 1-0, David.
Okay. I wasn't even allowed to guess.
No,
so
I knew you wouldn't guess that one. Okay.
What was the bar of my scientific?
Science, David, we're moving on. Okay. I may not even pronounce this one correctly. Richard Bachman?
Oh, that's
Stephen King. Oh, King.
Stephen King.
I think you both got that.
Yes, yes. That's
okay, so it's 2-1, Ed.
2-1. He wrote The Running Man under under Richard Bachman.
Yeah, The Long Walk, Roadwork, The Running Man, Thinner, The Regulators, and Blaze.
Mm-hmm.
And according to this, I should give credit to where I found this. It was in something called thoughtco.com, which is a fun website. According to them, publishers, Ed, maybe you know this, publishers were limiting authors to one book per year. And he didn't like the fact that he was limited to that. So he created the pseudonym so he could write more and publish more.
Really? That's, fascinating.
Yeah. That's why I came up with it. Okay. Last one. Oh, this might just give it away. The pseudonym was Mrs. Silence Duguid.
That doesn't give it away.
No. Mrs. Silence Duguid? Sounds like a mad parody. Go ahead.
And it's not a porn star. It's not a porn star.
It wouldn't be Silence if it was a porn star, but go ahead.
My second
okay,
guess.
This a second hint. This person couldn't get these, was sending in, you know, funny stories and essays and things like that to one of the first American newspapers, and they wouldn't publish them. So he put them under this pseudonym and wrote about things like hoop skirts.
A humorous
beers.
Oh, good guess. No guesses?
I mean, I'm one of the first American newspapers. I guess it could be late enough, but I'm going to hoop skirts.
Ben Franklin.
Say it again, David.
Ben Franklin.
Yay, David ties
nice!
It up.
Nice.
It's a tie. Nobody wins.
I'm showing
good
the
job,
best
guys.
American historical knowledge.
Okay. From pseudonyms to the so-called best book of the last 125 years.
Yes.
So I don't know if you guys read the New York Times book review every Sunday, but I look at it just to torture myself because it is the most pretentiously produced, edited, written. The section that they've had for 100 years now, and it used to be really fun where they'd ask the authors, some famous author, and they just ask them things. It's like a version of 60 seconds more than we do at the end of the show. But the answers have become so contrived and so clearly written by publicists and staff. It's just awful. But anyways, only the New York Times could say, okay, we, the book review, have been around for 125 years, and we want to ask our readers, and the book review really did start out originally asking readers of the paper to give ideas and suggestions of books that should be reviewed. So in the name of inclusiveness, they wanted to ask the readers to say, okay, best books of the 125 years of the book review. So the setup is this. They started out last year. They got nominations from every one of the 50 states and over 60 countries. And then in November, presented a list of the 25 most nominated authors/books. Over 200,000 people voted. That suspiciously, they did not break down where the votes came from. Right. But the winner by a very narrow margin was To Kill a Mockingbird, 1960.
Yes.
The Fellowship of the Ring by Tolkien, 1954. 1984 by George Orwell, 1949. 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez in 67. And Beloved by Toni Morrison in 87. Ed, you're first. Agree, disagree, love them, hate them? Are there any you haven't read?
I've read all of them. I was never that moved by, I was impressed by, but not moved by To Kill a Mockingbird. And, you know, so I've never held it in the same reverence that everybody else does. And I haven't, you know, I have always had an issue with best of lists because, you know, when you've worked, you know, with any kind of award, or you've known people who've worked with awards, you get very quickly get a jaded view of the process, which isn't to say that as jaded as my view has become over the years, generally the finalists for any award, and I thought the finalists for this one, you know, I don't disagree with the choices. You know, I don't think there's somebody who absolutely doesn't deserve to be there. Their book, in general, I haven't read them all, you know, when it gets to that point. But the ones that I've read, I'm impressed by. I was a little surprised at some of the omissions. And I sort of grew up studying American realism, especially you know, early 20th century. So it was very much the canon of, you know, Hemingway and Faulkner and Virginia Woolf and those writers. And, you know, so not seeing them in the lead was a bit shocking. Also, you know, James Baldwin's my favorite writer.
Right.
So not seeing him in the top, especially after his recent popularity, was a little surprising.
Yeah. Again, I have no idea where the 200,000 people came from. David?
Yeah.
Love this list, hate this list, agree, disagree?
I mean, as you mentioned, it's the New York Times, so you have to kind of take this with a grain of salt. Even their readers, who I'm sure in the main are very nice people, but, you know, people who read the New York Times regularly tend to come from a certain worldview. That's not as inclusive as I would like, for example, but that's okay. So it's fine to have the list. I love To Kill a Mockingbird. I've told you that a million times. But I certainly would not sit around going, it's the greatest book ever written. Like, it's a ridiculous thing to say. You know, it's a book that I like, but other people like other writers, you know, like, it doesn't bother me. And then to think that you could possibly cobble a list of any meaning or magnitude is just, it's the arrogance train to Mars. Okay. Like, it's just insane.
Okay. But that's the New York Times Book Review. It is the arrogance train to Mars. It really is. It absolutely is. I was kind of surprised To Kill a Mockingbird ended up on top, probably because I'm always surprised at how that it holds on.
Yeah.
It holds on and it, you know, it just hangs on and hangs on and hangs on. I was kind of surprised Toni Morrison wasn't higher. I just think Beloved is such an important book. But again, who knows? So some years ago, I got to make sure because our author doesn't go away.
Yeah, because he's like, why am I still here?
Okay, I'll tell this story quickly.
The worst podcast I've ever been booked on.
I'll tell the story just to blow this thing about when this kind of, I'm sure it was online voting, right? Mm. So several years ago, some number of our children went to a school over in Northern Virginia. We'll leave the name out of it. And at the time, one of the local TV stations in DC had this, essentially was a contest. And if you wanted, say that your high school was playing a big basketball game that weekend and you wanted them to cover it, they had this online voting thing. And whichever schools got the greatest number of votes, they would be playing, they would be on TV that Friday night or Saturday or whatever it was, right? This school, I promise you, would never appear on any network anytime. And there was a young man whose name shall not ever be named. But in sixth, seventh grade, this kid was the nerd of all nerds. And by high school, he had figured out A, how to hack into systems, B, how to manage a robocall system so that this small school that didn't have a snowball's chance in hell of ever being covered by anybody got the greatest number of votes. And their game was covered that Friday night.
Is he related to you by birth, by chance?
No, none of mine were that smart, David. If that was one of my kids, I'd be bragging about them. Okay, let's go to James Kestrel or whatever his name is. James Kestrel, welcome to Chatter on Books. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Are you in Hawaii?
Yes, I'm in Hawaii right now in my office in Honolulu.
Very seldom are the bios on the inside cover of books interesting. But I have to read yours because it's so spectacular. Formerly a bar owner, a criminal defense investigator, and an English teacher, James Kestrel is now an attorney practicing throughout the Pacific. His writing has won advanced praise from Stephen King, James Patterson, 18 other famous people, and numerous other authors. A sailor and world traveler, Kestrel has lived in Taiwan, New Orleans, and a West Texas ghost town. He lives in Volcano, Hawaii. Love spectacular. That. Best ever.
It's almost all true.
Okay, Volcano, Hawaii, true?
Okay, so I own a house in Volcano, and so that's on the Big Island of Hawaii, right next to the entrance to Volcano National Park. And I have a house there, but I unfortunately, because of this pandemic situation, have not gotten to exactly live there very much in the last 2 years. But I do a lot of writing there when I get the chance. And I used to kind of split my time between the two houses.
What is the pandemic like in Hawaii?
Well, our cases have been going up, but it has never been anything like it looks like it has been on the mainland. We've been spared a lot of that. Part of that was that early on, we had a quarantine requirement for anybody coming in, so that anybody coming in was subject to a 14-day quarantine. So that kept a lot of people out.
Sure.
And so that was at the expense of our tourism industry, which other than the military is kind of the backbone of our economy. So it was a real blow to us in 2020, economically speaking. But as far as disease goes, it hasn't been that bad here.
That's good. Okay, yeah. Let's go back to pseudonyms. Ed, who's with us, also had a pseudonym. And then I was going to go on to 14 other names just to keep us guessing all the time. Why did you pick a pseudonym and how did you pick James Kestrel?
Well, for why I did it, basically, I had written 6 books under my own name. The last 4 came out through Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and they got good blurbs and good reviews, but they just didn't sell very well in the United States. And this is where I drop an asterisk and note that I'm big in Bulgaria, but they just they just didn't sell that well here. And so my new editor at Hard Case Crime was concerned that if we went out under my own name, all the big booksellers would look at my previous sales and order only that many copies or less.
Wow.
And we'd be sort of doomed from the start. So we decided to go out under a pseudonym, but not to make it a secret that it was a pseudonym, and not to try too hard to keep it under wraps until at least the initial orders were made, and then, you know, not worry about it. So that's what we did, and it seems to have worked.
Okay. Well, I would suggest that maybe the book really helped. But Ed, what do you think about that strategy on that pseudonym?
Oh, I mean, I was, you know, my situation was similar, and I did the same thing. You know, I kept it an open secret because I've done a lot with my name in the DC area, and I didn't want to necessarily lose that with the next book. So I kept it an open secret, but I've never quite understood the reasoning from publishers, because, you know, anybody could Google me. It's not hard to find, you know, who I am. And it wouldn't be that difficult to look at that book and see the author is the same person who did another one if they were curious. But I trusted in the publishers and their expertise for that. And I was fine to do that. But like I said earlier, you really have to have the right, you know, approach and attitude and I think maybe the right book as well to do a successful pseudonym. And I didn't have at least 2 of those 3 things.
Yeah, good books. Okay, Kestrel. How did you come up with Kestrel?
Well, so I have a friend in the UK who writes under a pen name. She writes under the pen name Ellie Griffiths. And she and I were having a conversation once about pen names. And this was long before I had even written 5 Decembers. And I had asked her how she came up with hers. And she told me that when you pick a pen name, you need to pick something from the middle of the alphabet, so that if a bookstore is stocking books and they start at the top of a shelf on A and then Z's are down at the bottom, you want to be somewhere around eye level. And I remembered that and I thought, that's a good idea. So I decided to go with something from the middle of the alphabet. And then I was just sort of brainstorming, and I really like kestrels. I think they're amazing birds, and so I just went with that.
Are they in Hawaii?
No, I don't think there's no kestrels here.
Okay.
We have a species of hawk.
Okay. Going back to the books, remember in the old days when people had bookstores and you went into bookstores and bought books? The trick evidently was, if you could, I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but not by much. If somebody was enticed enough to physically pick up a book, there was a 35-50% greater chance that they would actually buy the book. And so authors, I wouldn't know any who did this, would go into a Barnes & Noble or go into whatever, Politics and Prose. First unionized bookstore, by the way. Good for the people of Politics and Prose. Go in, and if the book was lined up with all the other books, pull it out and pull it around so it's facing out, if you will, and almost toppling out, so people would be inclined to pick up that book. Yeah. Didn't work with mine, but it was tried. It was tried many times. Okay. Let's talk about 5 Decembers. And I want you to tell us in your own words, because it'd be too easy for me to give away some of the really important parts of the book. give us the CNN headlines version of it. But before anything else, and I have to admit, this is how your book Five Decembers came on my radar screen. I saw a tweet by Stephen King, who said some absolutely wonderful things about your book, including it blew me away. So when did you first see that Stephen King was saying wonderful things about your book, and how did it make you feel?
Well, it made me feel wonderful. And I saw it probably within a few minutes of when he first tweeted that, because I follow him on Twitter and I just happened to have Twitter open on my desktop when he tweeted it. I had no advance warning that it was going to happen. I know that my editor had given him a copy of the book more than a year ago. And when he tweeted it, I immediately told my editor, who then gave me some backstory that I thought was hilarious, which was that Stephen King had a copy of my book, but he forgot he had it. And he was just in his local bookstore, and apparently it was face out, and he picked it up and he thought, oh, this looks good. And so he bought it, and then he tweeted it. So it
wow.
was a,
see,
it was
face out.
Sale.
You gotta be face out.
Gotta be face out.
Okay, Ed, wait a minute. We'll come back to Five Decembers, I promise, because it's fabulous. Ed, who's your most desired tweet? If somebody was tweeting out something nice about your writing, who would just knock your socks off and you go, wow, that's the best ever?
I mean, for me, the writer who would really mean the world to me would be probably somebody James is definitely familiar with, Megan Abbott.
Megan Abbott.
Yeah, I'm such a fan of hers, and I've interviewed her and I've talked to her, and I have no idea how to talk to anybody that I admire. So there's no chance that she would talk to me ever again after I disgraced myself.
She too says nice things about Five Decembers. Okay, David, who more famous than David Aldridge has tweeted out nice things about your work?
Oh gosh, I have no idea. I mean, I don't obsess about it that much. So I'm sure. So I don't know that I'm famous, first of all. And secondly, that anyone famous has ever tweeted out my stuff. I'm sure some athlete, some basketball player at some point maybe did, but I don't know. I don't keep track of those things. I want Barack Obama to tweet out something nice about me, not because of his politics, but because he has 130 million Twitter followers.
Yeah. You know, David, just to go down a path here for a minute.
Yeah.
You're committed to writing a book, and I have an idea of a really easy book you could write.
Uh-huh.
I could get you. You can get an interview with Barack Obama because he does know you and he doesn't.
I've interviewed Barack Obama.
Yeah. So we could get that done.
A schlub like me can interview him. Anybody can, right?
We could get that done. Yeah.
Let's get back to our author. Can I tell James something here?
Author.
James.
Yeah.
Yes.
Go. Yes.
James, I cannot tell you what a bad mood I was in last week. Just the worst, most awful, miserable, don't come within 3 nautical miles of me because I am angry and depressed, and it happens after every Christmas and before every New Year's. That week's a bad week for me. And I read your book and it was so wonderful. What a great book. It was phenomenal. It picked me up right away. It was a great read. It was interesting. I could not believe that no one had thought of this as a topic before, as an idea. What a great idea. And it was so well written. Kudos to you, sir. It was wonderful. What a great book.
It's so great.
Well, thank you so much.
I need to echo that because I was stunned. I loved it. I was in a good mood. I love Christmas and New Year's. I was really happy. And this book just was so skillfully written. The kind of book that I read, and it's kind of like writers like Lou Burney or PJ Vernon, who you had on Chatter and Books earlier. They write it, and it's so good. And I'm like, it makes me a little sad because I'm like, I want to write that well. You touch something that's beautiful, and I was just is taut and tense and aching. I was so impressed.
Yay! Okay, tell us why they were so impressed, author. Give us the CNN headline version of the thumbnail sketch of the plot without giving away too much.
Oh, okay, it begins as a sort of traditional noir murder mystery. In Honolulu, Hawaii, in November 1941, on just like the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. And the main character is a homicide detective with the Honolulu Police Department. And he gets called out to a murder scene on the windward side of the island in a fairly remote location. He finds two dead bodies up there. One of them is a young man who is identifiable as the nephew of Admiral Kimmel, who was then in charge of Pearl Harbor. And the other was an unidentifiable young Japanese woman. And following up on his investigation, he discovers some clues that lead everybody to believe that one of the killers fled Oahu on the Pan Am Clipper flight from the would island hop from San Francisco to Hong Kong. And given the status of one of the victims, the detective is put on the next plane out and is sent to Hong Kong to follow up. And every modern reader knows what's happening as he gets on that plane on December 1st and takes a week getting out to Hong Kong, lands there on December 7th, 1941, which is December 6th in Hawaii. And then the next day, his entire investigation is turned upside down when the Japanese attack from Honolulu to Hong Kong. And so he spends the war in a kind of odd situation in Japan, and then gets back to solve his case and get his man. And so there's a big shift in the middle of the book that takes it, I think, outside of what you would normally expect in a noir mystery.
Yeah, it's, as so many of the reviews have said, it's so much more than a noir mystery. Talk to us about the inspiration, because I think David said it. Why did somebody not have this idea before? And it's a very original take. So what was the inspiration?
When I first started getting ideas for the book, at the time I was doing a lot of work in, I was having to travel to Tokyo a lot, and I was having to travel to Hong Kong a lot. So I was on airplanes a lot, and I was in those two cities a lot. And I love history, and I love walking around and exploring places. And so I started thinking about the connections between Tokyo and Honolulu, especially, and also Hong Kong and Honolulu. And I had written six other books, but I had never tried anything really big, and I wanted to try something really big. And then I realized that if I put a detective in there and I set it during World War II, I could have this just huge canvas for the story to play out on. And so it kind of developed from there. But the initial idea of the book was always for the detective to somehow or another wind up on the wrong side of enemy lines when the war broke out, so that he was trapped, and so that his investigation would basically get put on ice for the duration of the war. And so I always knew that that was kind of the main thing that I wanted to try and achieve in the book, and took some time to figure out how to pull it off.
Well, and you did. And can I ask why? And again, I'm going to be so careful not to give things away. This is in no way an apology for the Japanese side of the war, but you certainly have the perspective and the context of what happens on the Japanese side or in Japanese society. Where did that come from?
I have a bunch of clients in Japan, and a few of them have become really good friends. One of them who is high on my list of the most interesting people I've ever met, he's an incredibly fluent English speaker, possibly more fluent than me. He used to be a journalist in Japan, and his beat was nuclear weapons issues. And so he had grown up in Hiroshima, and both sets of his grandparents were vaporized there. And he ended up becoming friends with Paul Tibbetts. And they would exchange Christmas cards for years until Tibbetts died.
Wow.
He took me on a walking tour of Tokyo to show me what visible damage was left from the firebombings there. He was able to really show me a lot of things on the Japanese side of the war that I certainly wasn't aware of and never really appreciated before. So he opened my eyes to a lot of things and showed me aspects of the story that I could put in that I really wanted to try and capture.
Well, you definitely captured it. Tell us about our hero. Tell us about our protagonist in the story and who plays him in the Netflix series.
So the main character's name is Joe McGrady, and he's too young to have been in World War I. I'm thinking probably around 35 at the time that the story begins, but he had been in the army in the sort of weird interwar years of the American army when, as everyone knows, when the war broke out, the American army wasn't exactly at peak strength or top condition. Yeah. And in the 1930s, when he was in the army, it was also not, this vast war fighting machine that it eventually became. Oh. But he had seen some action in the Fujian Rebellion, where elements of the American military participated in protecting consulates in China. And so because of that experience and his just sort of general interest in languages, he had picked up some Chinese. And then his last posting in the army was in Honolulu. And then when he mustered out, he ended up joining HPD. So he's sort of an outsider here. You can, just as an aside, you can live, if you're not born in Hawaii, you could live in Hawaii for like 30 or 40 years and still be considered not from outsider. Here.
Yeah.
And both of my kids were born here, but I'm not even sure if they would count as being from here since their parents aren't. So he's a bit of an outsider everywhere he goes, but he's comfortable with that and is comfortable just going anywhere in the world and trying to find his answers.
And did you base him on some person or people you know in real life or out of whole cloth?
Yeah, I would say it's out of whole cloth, and I certainly don't try and write myself into anything. So whenever somebody reads one of my books, they're often tempted to say, "Now, which one is you?" And,
Okay, Ed, I want you to jump in here because one of the things we talked about before, it's just an incredible book. And one of the things that I was so struck by is there's this incredible pace and tension and building. And then there'd be a little, not a break, but a little bit of a, there's some context or some history given or something. And I found myself almost physically taking a breath, which I really appreciated. But how does one do that, right? And in your opinion, this broader canvas that he's talking about, is that something all writers should be thinking about when they're trying to do a story like this?
One of the things that I always say that when writing a book, especially crime fiction, I you want to write kind of like junk food. You know, you want people to eat it and then get sort of ravenous and want more and more. And then afterwards to feel a little unsettled.
like David after the holidays.
A little unsure about what you just absorbed. And one of the things that I found so fascinating in this book, James, and a question I had for you actually that ties into this. Yeah, the pace you kept was remarkable, considering that your character is Joe is outside of all of these major events that are happening. There's big stuff that happens in the book, and I don't want to give anything away, but you seem to have made a conscious effort to have him outside of those. Almost. And I think another writer would have been tempted to write the big war scenes or something like that, or the big bombing scenes. And instead yours are a little put back, but the tension is still maintained. I was wondering if that was your intention the entire time, or did you ever consider putting him more directly in some of those scenes?
I think it was a conscious decision to keep the war as the backdrop and sort of the canvas on which the novel takes place, but not to have him become a main character in all of these major events. And part of my fear was that if I started doing that, it could kind of become a Forrest Gump situation where this guy is incongruously popping up all over the place, and the background is, the surrender treaties being signed, and he's back there knocking over, the Pepsis or whatever. Right. So I just didn't want that to happen. And so I wanted the story to be its own story, but to take place within the context of these larger events and let those events shape him.
Okay, let's get you out with this on the real questions, author. I don't agree with you. I don't think it was a change in your name using a pseudonym that made this one so much more successful than the previous seven. You did seven novels before this one? Six before. Okay. What do you think makes this one better? So much better.
I think it's far more ambitious than anything I've written before. Hmm. And it's a bigger book. It's got a more tender story in the middle of it than anything I've tried. And because of the time span that it takes place in, all of my other books take place in a very compressed time span, you know, 3-4 days, and you're with the character the whole time. And that doesn't allow the character, it can make for nice pacing, but it doesn't allow the character much time to grow or change or to develop, like, you know, real relationships with other people. Whereas in this story, I think there is the space for me to do that.
Yeah, it's fabulous. Okay, before we do 60 seconds more, Ed, David, any more questions, thoughts?
I mean, you've talked about it a little bit, but the whole, it can almost be a parody if you try to write noir, right? I mean, we've all read really good Raymond Chandler type of stuff that's kind of, that people loved back in the day, but we've also read some really bad versions of it, right? So I just wonder, like, how did you ever worry about, hey, I don't want this to become something that I see on Saturday Night Live. You know what I mean? Like, because it wasn't, it was really well written. But if you go down that route, you have to commit to it all the way or it doesn't work. And I just wonder how you work through that.
I don't know. There was a lot of editing involved, I'll tell you that much. The original manuscript was almost 700 pages long. Wow. And my agent saw it and just freaked out. And so, you know, she gave me all these notes on what to do with it. And so then I made it longer and she freaked out even more. And so in the end, I ended up cutting 60,000 words from it.
Oh, wow. Like
almost the length of the book.
Right.
And that process really improved it because I had to really question everything that was in it in order to get it cut down that.
Yeah.
Oh. And then, you know, I should also mention that once we sold it to Hard Case Crime, then I was working with Hard Case's editor, Charles Ardai, he's actually just a genius. He's an incredibly good editor. Never worked with anyone like him before. And so that was a real pleasure.
Hey, James, author, tell us about Hard Case Crime. Because it's not something with whom a lot of people are familiar. I'm sure Ed is, David probably is, but it's not something with whom a lot of people are familiar. So tell us about that.
Okay, so Hard Case is a really neat publishing company, and it's the brainchild of Charles Ardai. And so Hard Case is Charles Ardai. So he is a one-man operation, and he can do this because he's some kind of internet billionaire from having founded an early version of something like Yahoo and then selling it. And so anyway, he has time and money to spend on his project. And so he's partnered with Titan Books out of the UK. Prior to that, he was partnered with Dorchester, I believe, before that company folded. But his mission is to publish pulp and noir, and with the sort of the look and feel of the books he would have bought in the train station in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. And a lot of his books are reprints of out of print originals. And then he publishes a few a year that are original books. And Stephen King basically put him on the map. One of his first books was a Stephen King original. And then Stephen King has published, I think, two more with him, Joyland, and this year he published a book called Later.
Wow. And very cool. Yeah.
No, it's great.
Yeah, we're glad they exist. We're glad they found you. Okay. Yeah,
and their covers are really great.
Yes, the cover was great.
It's a podcast, but the cover is very evocative. And it does make, I mean, face out. That's the watchword, people. Face out in the book. It makes you want to pick up the book. So hats off to the design of that. Okay, if you could only take one book, this is our deserted island question, which we now put on our authors. If you could, you've got to go to deserted island for the rest of your life. You can only take one book with you. What do you take with you?
How to Survive on Land and Sea by the U.S. Navy.
That's a good one. Yeah, excellent. Good advice. Okay. James Kestrel, Jonathan, whatever your name is. The book is Five Decembers. It is fabulous, fabulous, fabulous.
Great book.
You love the holidays. Awesome. You hate the holidays. You should go get this book at your favorite independent bookstore. Thank you so much for joining us. A little bit of housekeeping. Download us, review us, all those things, blah, blah, blah. We are back next week, and I am guaranteeing that I am probably going to cry, but we are back next week with Steve Roberts, who is a Washington, D.C. political journalist institution. And he has written an incredible tribute and a love letter to his dear wife and partner, Cokie Roberts, who was one of the early authors on this show. Yes. And I just can't say enough good things about her, about Steve, and about the book. So we will have them on next week. Lauren, thank you for making everything happen. Ed and David, thank you very much. James, everybody, seriously, stay healthy, get boosted, and we'll see you next week.